I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. In 1975, fresh out of law school and working at a boring job in the Treasury Department, John Rizzo decided to take a shot in the dark and send his resume to the CIA. He had no idea that this decision would lead to over three decades at the agency and a front row seat to some of its greatest controversies. In Company Man, 30 years of controversy and crisis in the CIA, the former chief legal officer reflects on his career, from answering for the Iran-Contra scandal to approving the use of enhanced interrogation techniques like waterboarding in the wake of 9/11. It's published by Scribner, and I'm very pleased it brings John to the Leonard Lopate Show today. How are you, John?
Good. Thanks. Nice to be here.
So this is, it's interesting. Your book came out. It's not, I guess, a tell-all, but it's a tell-a-lot story about your time at the CIA. And I noticed, yesterday a big story was that our former Secretary of Defense has come out with a memoir, sort of that's his tell-all about his years working in that capacity. Do you have any reflections on what you've heard about that book yet, or are you not that familiar with what he's?
Well, I am familiar with Bob Gates. I mean, of course, he started out as a career CIA employee, became CIA director, and I actually talk about him in the book during the time he was CIA director and before that when he was a key figure in Iran-Contra. Yeah, I mean, I was fascinated to hear the reports. I always knew Bob Gates, and he was a very careful, deliberate, tight-button guy who wasn't given to sort of extravagant statements or headline-making statements, frankly. So I don't know. He's just turned 70, I believe. Perhaps he had an epiphany and decided to let it all hang out.
He had a few things to say.
Yeah.
So 30 years, three decades at the CIA, is this something you had in mind when you were a kid? Did you like spy stuff? Were you interested in that whole kind of thing?
No. That was one of the ironies. Looking back on my life, the way it played out, I mean, that was one of the ironies. I never, I'm a baby boomer, so I grew up, came of age in the 50s and the early 60s. I mean, apart from going to a couple of the old Sean Connery, James Bond movies when I was a teenager and, living that vicarious fantasy. I never read spy novels. I never, frankly, gave much thought to CIA. I was a kid growing up in a suburban town in Massachusetts. So how I got there, it's something I would never have predicted when I was younger.
So did you... you were working in this job. What was your job at the Treasury Department that was so boring that...
I should say, in fairness, there were good things about the job there. I liked the people I worked with. I was just out of law school, so it was a good entry level job. But it was actually the U.S. Customs Service was then part of the Treasury Department, and there was some interesting work in narcotics enforcement, but there was a lot of reviewing claims, tort claims by visitors coming to the country and had their cars soiled by customs dogs looking for marijuana, that kind of thing. Plus, I never had the opportunity, you never had the authority to actually sign a memo or letter going out of the customs service. And I found that, frankly, stultifying.
So you send in your resume into the CIA, and what do they say back to you?
Well, first I said nothing.
That's common, I guess, at the CIA.
Again, I had no inside information. I knew no one at the CIA. I just literally threw the resume, not literally, figuratively threw the resume over the barbed wire fence there. And I heard nothing for 3 weeks. And I figured, well, that's that. CIA doesn't have to explain anything to anybody. And then sitting in my office... a few days later, I got this, pleasant female voice on the telephone asking me to come out to Langley for an interview.
That's how it started. Yeah. And so, what were the assignments you had early in your career? First of all, what was their training like? I mean, what did you you come in on a Monday morning at the CIA, and what happens?
Well, Andy, you have to keep in mind I was a lawyer. I wasn't a spy.
Right.
So
I was just trying to glam it up a little bit for your readership.
Well, I mean, for lawyers, pretty...
No one is busier at the CIA than lawyers, though, I can imagine.
Well, that's... Yeah. One of the reasons I wanted to write the book is I honestly don't believe many people in the public or generally associate the words lawyer with CIA.
Right.
That you know, CIA has the image and for movies and TV and, you know, being this big, bad, monolithic behemoth doing whatever it wanted. And the fact is that lawyers, CIA lawyers, play an enormously very intrinsic role in the day-to-day mission and, of the agency across the board, but especially in the covert operations side. And I was lucky when I first arrived to CIA as a 28-year-old kid. I was given some assignments, which were, you know, albeit not spy assignments, but they exposed me to the spy side of the business at a very early age, and certainly gave me, it was a template for the rest of my career.
There's a story about you're dealing with a defected KGB agent named Yuri Nosenko. How did that go down?
Well, Yuri Nosenko, name may be familiar to some of your listeners, but he was a member of the KGB, a middle rank apparatchik, really, of the KGB, who defected to the U.S. or to the U.S. Embassy in Moscow a few months after the assassination of President Kennedy. Nosenko defected, I believe, in February 64. And lo and behold, Nosenko, you know, defecting KGB agents for certainly during the Cold War were considered a prized
sure.
Catch for the CIA. So he would have been welcomed in any event. But he not only defected when he did, he said he had access to the KGB file of Lee Harvey Oswald and could state authoritatively that there was no connection between the CIA and Lee Harvey Oswald. He was brought over to the United States to be resettled. I mean, this story qualifies for a book unto itself, so I'll try to be concise. There was a legendary old counterintelligence maven at CIA time named James Jesus Angleton, who believed that Nosenko was a plant, was sent over by the Soviets to basically hide what Angleton believed to be some connection between the KGB and Oswald. So this is now we're talking in the mid-60s. He was CIA leadership. I should know parenthetically, in the mid-60s, I was still in high school, so I had nothing to do with this particular action. But he was basically confined, put in a small room, and subjected to fairly brutal deprivations for 2 or 3 years by CIA people to try to break him, try to get him to talk and recant. And he never did. Eventually, mercifully, he was rehabilitated, sent down to under a new name, a new life, a new wife, to be resettled in a sleepy little bucolic town in the south. And I was sent down in the late 70s to help him work out a legal issue he had with his will.
Mm-hmm.
And it wound up into an all-night drunken homemade vodka, or vodka, as he referred to it, discussion with this guy who looked across between Ernest Borgnine and Victor McLagan.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking to John Rizzo about his 30 years at the CIA. He's written a new book about it called Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA, and it's out from Scribner. We got a listener just called in to say that after World War II, you'll have to verify this, whether this is authentic or not. He said, after World War II, Japanese were put on trial and convicted for waterboarding. It was seen as a crime. Well, we're going to talk about this. They were hung. Okay. Okay, first of all, I have no way of knowing whether that's true. I'm just it's a listener making this observation. So I guess what he's raising is the issue of waterboarding, the use of the CIA of waterboarding. Obviously, it plays a big role in your book, the controversy surrounding that. First of all, let me ask you a question. What do you – there's so much difference of opinion about whether a technique like waterboarding is even effective. You know, it can force somebody to get you to stop waterboarding them, but it's a question of what the quality of intelligence or information you get. My producer's saying that they checked it on. There are some reports that some people were actually executed for waterboarding after World War II. But maybe we'll get some more guidance on that. But from your perspective, is waterboarding even is it even an effective interrogation technique?
Well, I mean, the short answer is I think it proved to be one of a series of techniques that could and did elicit valuable and otherwise unobtainable intelligence information.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, there's been this controversy about waterboarding, you know, for the past decade. It's a very complex subject. That is my conclusion from what I could judge and see on the inside of CIA, the kinds of intelligence that was being produced. But frankly, waterboarding sometimes is overemphasized, in these looking back during in that era. Only three CIA detainees were waterboarded,
mm-hmm.
including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-proclaimed mastermind of 9/11. It was not used after 2003. As I say, all the evidence I had, all the people I respected, the career CIA experts who had been there, you know, long before the Bush administration, were convinced that it was not only effective, but it was indispensable,
mm-hmm.
an indispensable tool. But, I mean, I certainly understand how people, you know, could feel differently. As for the Japanese, the question from your viewer about waterboarding and the Japanese situation, you know, what the waterboarding technique as it was employed by CIA bore little in comparison to some of the, you know, the kinds of waterboardings that the Japanese had done, or I believe the Khmer Rouge had done in Cambodia. So to just have a
what were the different? I'm not an expert in waterboarding. So what were the differences between the way they used it and the way we used it?
Well, the way the CIA employed, first of all, it was supervised constantly by medical personnel on the scene,
mm-hmm.
according to specific guidelines. Only a couple of applications at a time. When I say applications, this is putting a small amount of water on a cloth that was across the detainee's mouth. Now, Andy, I don't want to get in any of this. I don't want to sort of give the impression that waterboarding was benign. It was not.
Right.
Even the way CIA conducted it, it was harsh. But it was regulated, it was controlled, and it was used sparingly and only when it was absolutely necessary.
Although I should point out that according to the 9/11 commission report, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded 183 times. So that's not sparingly. And from his point of view, probably not too sparingly. But
Well, when I meant sparingly, I meant sparingly on detainees.
Yeah.
As I indicate, he was certainly one of the three, and he
right.
was by far waterboarded the most.
Right. And okay. Well, it's going to continue to be controversial, obviously. Uh-huh. And that was obviously a big part of your job at the CIA was sort of wading through these controversies. It started actually in the 70s. Just go back a bit towards the beginning of your career, the Church Committee after Watergate came out and investigated all the operations of all the intelligence agencies. What was the committee's findings?
Well, I mean, as I say, I owe the Church Committee for my coming to the CIA. Among many other conclusions the Church Committee reached in its 1975 report was that CIA needed more lawyers.
And that was good for you.
That was my entree. I mean, as a matter of fact, that's what prompted me to even consider applying. I was 26-year-old guy reading all the media reports about what the Church Committee was uncovering about CIA, knowing nothing about CIA. It did occur to me. I have no idea whether CIA needs lawyers, but if they don't, I suspect they're going to need them now. So So the church committee report findings, the whole, and this was a huge controversy back in the mid-70s, because this was detailing CIA plots, you know, from the 1950s onward, assassination plots and the like. Pretty gnarly stuff. But the church committee is really the reason why I believe I was hired at CIA.
They needed more lawyers.
Yeah. And they need lawyers who didn't have any so-called CIA baggage that could view as coming to sort of to take a fresh look. And God knows I was fresh in those days.
So in 1979, you were named legal advisor to the Directorate of Operations.
Yeah, that's the spy service.
What is that exactly? The names of everything at the CIA, I think.
Well, yeah, they're sometimes deceptively pablum sounding.
Right, as bureaucratic and bland as possible.
Yeah. No, the director of operations are the spies. It is the chief spy service. It's M in the James Bond series. I believe it's M, or is it Q? I can't. As I say, I didn't read
M.
much.
M. I think it's okay. M. Q is the gadgets.
Oh, the gadget guy. Okay,
right.
We have gadget guys too. So yeah, that's the entity, the director of operations, that carries out all the so-called spook activities, covert intelligence collection, covert action. So that's where it resides. And I was selected again after being at the agency for only a couple of years to be their in-house legal counsel. In other words, I would physically sit in that part of Langley that housed all the headquarters clandestine service people.
Now, a big part of your job was writing what are called findings, which is another great term.
Findings. Yes.
What is a finding? What do they entail?
A finding is actually a term of ours, a presidential finding. Those are documents that literally are signed by the President of the United States, directing CIA to undertake a particular covert action operation. When I say covert action, I don't mean to collect intelligence. Covert action is when you're, for instance, secretly arming a paramilitary force, or supplying gear of one kind or another. The CIA activities in Afghanistan, for instance, both in the late 70s and after 9/11, those were covert action programs. The enhanced interrogation program was a covert action program. So these are the documents that basically authorize those. By law, they have to be physically signed by the president, so there's accountability to the president. And at an early age, I was assigned to write these documents up. So it was quite a heady experience.
Okay, I want to talk more about those documents and how you wrote them. I'm speaking with John Rizzo, the former top lawyer at the CIA, about the agency's enhanced interrogation program and its so-called black sites. His book, Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA, is published by Scribner, and we'll be back with more after a break. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, and for all of you lawyers out there who are listening to this program, and maybe you're bored with your corporate law job and you're looking for a more exciting life, how about the CIA? That's what my guest is talking about. He was a lawyer who jumped ship and joined the CIA and spent 30 years there. John Rizzo is the author of Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA. It's out from Scribner. So speaking of law and legal writing, you were writing these findings that were essentially orders for covert operations that the President of the United States had to sign for them to be enacted. But it was I thought it was fascinating how you described the wording that would go into these findings, because you had to be very euphemistic about everything, even though you were suggesting that we do some things. You were very cautious about how you described the things we were supposed to be doing.
Yeah, keep in mind, I'm talking here in the time frame. The law that requiring that there be such presidential findings was enacted in the mid-70s. So when I got involved in them in the late 70s, they were still a fairly new and unexplored art form. The Carter administration was in office at that point, and in its early couple of years, it really didn't do much in the form of covert action. So I mean, for lack of a better term, we at CIA had sort of make up the art form as we went along.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing, certainly the Carter administration, the White House was insistent on, and White Houses, you know, subsequently were similar in this regard. They realized they had their president had to sign these presidential findings for CIA to do its work. They were leery of the president putting his signature on a piece of paper that had the words like kill or lie
right.
In them. So we were asked at CIA to come up with euphemisms, not that would convey the meaning of the term, but not actually use those loaded terms. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't that we at CIA were avoiding the terms. I mean, the White House, and I say it's not. I don't mean to put this on the Carter White House. Most White Houses are rather reluctant to have their president be too close associated with those kinds of words. So, for instance, for instead of kill terrorists, it was lethal action against terrorists. Instead of printing false information to mislead the enemy, false information was translated into all forms of propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. So, as I say, it was a new art form that we're involved in, and those kinds of phrases have actually endured to this day in presidential findings.
It's really not that different from The Sopranos when Tony would say somebody needs to go away or something like that. He never said I want you to kill somebody.
Yeah, so. Yeah. By the way, let me just establish for the record here because I've been asked in other contexts. In all my years at CIA, I never heard the word "terminate" with extreme prejudice. That was never used.
Where did that come from?
I believe it came from spy novels and movies. So, similarly, while I'm at it, I realize the title of my book is "Company Man," and of course, a euphemism for CIA was a company. I never heard anyone at CIA during all my time, anyone who worked for CIA, refer to CIA as the company.
So
I just went up.
So you're just perpetuating that myth for the sake of sales.
Yeah.
But that's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine. It's
well,
okay.
I thought, frankly, there was an article written about me called The Company's Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a rather clever play on words, so my publisher suggested we use it as a title. So, but I don't want to have false advertising.
Well, the book is Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA. I'm talking to its author, John Rizzo, about his years at the CIA. You know, I was just, as you were describing misconceptions or myths about the CIA, I just had to ask you, do you watch Homeland? Have you ever watched Homeland?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I watch it avidly.
Oh, you do? What do you think of the portrayal of the CIA, just in terms of the verisimilitude? Does it seem at all believable?
You know, actually, I mean, everything's relative in this spy fiction genre about relation to reality. Actually, Homeland is a lot closer to the in terms of the atmospherics of CIA and the reality than any other movie or TV spy series I've seen. That said, there's still an elaborate leap of faith one has to take when you watch that in terms of the plot. I mean, it's a TV series,
right.
Not a documentary, but
right.
It's not bad. It's
right.
Really not bad.
Well, that's good to know. My only bone to pick with it is there only seem to be, at any given time, three people working at the CIA. It's like Claire Danes, Mandy Patinkin, and then like maybe one other guy, the Peter Quinn guy. But that's, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, the fact that you worked at the CIA and you enjoy the show actually speaks well of it, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I got a phone call last year out of the blue from someone in Los Angeles that I knew, serving as a media for the Homeland producers. They're about to start writing season 3. And they asked if they and their lawyers could bounce some ideas off me over the telephone. So I actually spent an enjoyable 90 minutes with them asking me questions and, you know, trying to lend some verisimilitude to at least some of the details. So that was enjoyable.
Well, speaking of findings and findings that you were involved in writing, one prominent one, at least in your account, is that you drafted a finding in 1998 to have Osama bin Laden captured. When did you, at the CIA, when did you first get a sense of what Osama bin Laden was up to, what he represented?
Well, you know, honestly,
because he had been on our team for a while. I mean,
well, he had been, you know, much younger version of him had been on the Mujahideen side against the Soviet invasion
in Afghanistan
in the late 70s.
Right,
and of course, since the agency was supplying the Mujahideen, covertly supporting them, one could say, I guess, that bin Laden was on our side. You know, on my radar, he frankly did not crop up until the mid-90s. I mean, I'd heard the name, and I'd heard he was a rich Saudi who was issuing, you know, fatwas, making vague threats against what he called a far enemy. But by 1998, I mean, 1998 is a key day because that was the date, of course, of the embassy bombings in Africa, the twin bombings in Africa.
Right.
I think that's really what brought him his name to the fore.
Well, what was your finding that you drafted? What did it, do you remember any of the language that you used to describe that covert mission?
Well, that was during the Clinton administration, and you know, one thing, Andy, you know, I keep trying to emphasize in the book is that, you know, CIA doesn't dream up findings on its own. It doesn't dream up covert actions. It's when the president or the White House directs us to come up with a plan.
So, right, and then you have to find a legal framework for that, right?
Yeah,
a legal language for it.
Yeah. And they're you know, in terms of writing these documents, it's a little tricky because you want to make them broad enough so that you don't have to run back to the president every time you want to do a new wrinkle on an already approved corporate action program. On the other hand, you want to make them specific enough so that there's not, you know, frankly, that the White House and the president are it's clear that they know what they're signing up to. So it's a delicate balance. And this, in 1998, it was the, you know, Clinton administration and obviously the president who directed that CIA come up with a plan to capture bin Laden. Obviously, unsuccessful plan, but that's when it started.
Well, we only have about 1 minute left, so I have to just ask you a question, which you can answer very completely. I know it's not your agency, but the NSA. What should happen to Edward Snowden? What should we do about him? You have 1 minute.
Well, I mean, I don't think he should be granted clemency, first of all. I believe he committed a crime. You know, in our system, one cannot allow a 29-year-old to take it upon himself to decide how many millions of existing secrets need to be spilled. So I think he's been indicted under our system. I think he should come back and face justice. Perhaps he'll be acquitted by a jury because of his arguments about you know the wrongdoing he's exposed. Perhaps not. But I certainly would not support clemency, and I really doubt that he will that will come to be.
Well, only time will tell. But you did that in 1 minute, which was superb. I appreciate that.
Okay.
I've been speaking to John Rizzo. He is the author of Company Man: 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA. It's out by Scribner. And John, thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you, Andy.